Look at toasters, corn, and TVs.
We still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Hello, Zero Books. Whoops. Let's see. Oops, I got to turn that off. Hello, Zero Books viewers and listeners and readers. It's Douglas Lane here. I'm here with A.M. Gitlitz, who is a journalist and social critic based in Brooklyn, New York, where all the dirtbag leftists live. He has contributed in the past to The New Inquiry, The New York Times, The Baffler, and Vice. But he is most famous to me anyway, for being the author of a book that's coming out or just come out this month from Pluto Press called I Want to Believe. That's a book all about the Posadas adventure on the left. So, A.M. Gitlitz, welcome to the Zero Books YouTube channel and live stream.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell us what your book is about. Who is Posadas, or who was Posadas? And what should we think about your book before we, you know, go out to the, well, I guess we can't go anywhere before we order it on whatever platform we want to order it from.
Well, so Posadas, of course, was Jay Posadas, born Homero Cristalli, an Argentinian Trotskyist, the leader of Latin American Trotskyism in the 50s and early 60s. His bureau, the Latin American Bureau of the Fourth International, split from the Fourth International in the early 60s, and he started his own international, the Fourth International Posadas, which had, you know, a number of important contributions to revolutionary socialism in the early 60s, including an important cadre in Cuba. They were the ideological head of the Guatemalan Civil War at its beginning. Major organizations in Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and Chile, and Bolivia. But of course, they became most known as the international started to fracture and fall apart. Posadas started to assert some of his more idiosyncratic ideas, most famously the belief that the UFO phenomenon is extraterrestrial of origin, that we ought to contact aliens if possible. He also wrote something very late in life, very marginal, but it's become very popular, about communication with dolphins, psychic communication with dolphins. But really what was most important to them politically was the belief in nuclear catastrophism, the belief that there needed to be a third world war, a nuclear third world war, in order to achieve socialism. And so those three tropes, although they made him kind of ridiculous and ridiculed at the time, today have sort of brought him back as like a folkloric celebrated figure in the history of revolutionary socialism. And I found actually by doing, you know, analytics of Google searches, that he's, at least in the United States and in England, one of the most searched for Trotskyist figures, a lot more than his rivals, who are much more serious intellects, and at times even higher than Trotsky himself. So the book is both about the history of the movement, like its real politics, but also why he's so resonant today, why he's become such a popular figure, what it means that he's become this kind of cartoon character celebrated online for the left today. Generally what this what appeals to people about aliens and catastrophe.
Well, you know, before we dive into the kind of contemporary Posadism that is taken off online, that's become popular through memes and jokes, and which I think is a reflection of a certain hopelessness on the left. Why don't we talk a little bit more about Posadas's actual trajectory historically? And I'd like to hear more about like what led him to most especially, I guess, embrace this idea that nuclear war was necessary. How was that connected to maybe Marxist crisis theories or those kinds of ideas that would be more seriously considered within Marxist circles.
Yeah, well, certainly there's been elements of catastrophism in the history of Marxism. Marx wrote about the long-term tendency of the rate of profit to fall, and you know, how that's going to create these spectacular destruction of capitalism at some point. The Second International's Erfurt program was based largely on the idea that capitalism would break down, and it was the task of the Second International to create these durable working class institutions to prepare for that eventuality. And after the Bolshevik Revolution, well, you know, before the World War One, Lenin predicted that World War One would lead to a position where revolution was suddenly possible, that they should turn the imperialist war into a civil war. And then after the war, even though this, you know, international revolution didn't really take place or had stopped in the Soviet Union, they believed that capitalism was still in its death throes. So socialism in one country became sort of this waiting game for capitalism to collapse. And Trotsky, after his exile from the Soviet Union, understood that there would be this massive war, this massive a new world war, imperialist conflagration, and that he would have to prepare a new communist movement to take the place of the deformed Soviet Union after World War II had horrifically, you know, destroyed millions of people, destroyed countries. He expected that the Fourth International that he formed would be looked to by the revolutionary proletariat internationally for leadership. Now, of course, this is not what happened. Stalin and the United States largely were victorious, and most of the Trotskyists were killed in the course of the war, both by fascists and agents of Stalin. Nonetheless, after the war, a lot of the surviving Trotskyists regrouped into they reformed the Fourth International shortly after the war. And the leading figure was a guy named Michel Pablo, originally from Egypt, of Greek ancestry, and he was living in France. And in 1949, he wrote an essay called "Where Are We Going?" that essentially held that the World War II hadn't ended, or that it would soon restart, that capitalism was in terminal crisis. It could collapse any day now. It was totally dependent on the Third World, which was also in this revolutionary upsurges all over the world, especially in China, soon in Algeria and Cuba, et cetera. So he predicted that within a few years, there would be the resumption of the World War or a new World War. And of course, now this would be a nuclear World War because the Soviet Union was nuclear armed. So this was actually the position of the Trotskyists in the early 50s. Now, there was a split in the Fourth International over this issue and others. But by the end of the 50s, Michel Pablo and his followers sort of softened on this position as capitalism stabilized in Western Europe. For that reason, and also basic questions of leadership, Posadas, who was leading the Latin American Bureau at the time, came into conflict with the European leadership of the Fourth International. He believed that, first of all, leadership should be moved to the Third World, preferably Latin America. And he also believed that they shouldn't abandon this position that nuclear war was coming, and they should continue pushing guerrilla insurrection, especially in Algeria and Cuba and that sort of thing. That anyone who was somehow against world war, who wanted nuclear disarmament or something like that, was too cowardly, basically, to be a revolutionary.
Now, that was that last bit, that was the Posadas position, or was that the mainstream Trot position?
That became the position Posadas was really well known for, as other Trotskyists were backing off of it. There were Trotskyists who were, you know, believed that the nuclear bomb was the workers' bomb, that believe the, you know, the conflict between Cuba and the United States should be deepened. But that position was far less popular in the early 60s. And Posadas sort of seized on that niche to recruit for his new international. He was recruiting these European cadres. And a lot of young Europeans who joined the Posadists in those years thought that Posadas was, you know, the biggest badass. because he wasn't afraid of nuclear war happening, even though it would mean the destruction of Western Europe.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's interesting. The I mean, it's easy kind of if you look back to see this as very kooky and to think that the Trots themselves were a little bit weird because they were seemingly thinking that they could project into the future, that they were like Nostradamus or something, right? Mm-hmm. Like they could just, they knew what was coming next. But if you think about what they were going through from the point of view of our present moment, you might, it's a little easier to understand what their thinking was like, because we're living through a moment which is, you know, filled with trauma and crisis. There's an economic crisis that's deepening every day. And it's easy for very wild ideas to seem immediate. Like we're not, like, you know, we're not projecting to the future to think, or at least contemplate the idea that many states will overturn electoral, you know, like the franchise in the years to come, or that the surveillance of our everyday lives will expand exponentially, something like that. I think someone could suggest, and it wouldn't seem like they were being too arrogant or full of hubris to try to play Nostradamus in that way, because there's so many things that indicate that on the ground right now. So I guess in the late 50s and 60s, the idea that a nuclear war was coming was also almost taken for granted. It was not seen as a wild idea.
No, I mean, this is like, I don't know how different our age is, but I, you know, I think our parents believed in this, basically, or at least they were afraid enough to take it way more seriously than we do. I mean, we're more afraid of climate change or...
Well, I think I'm a little bit older than you. And I was born in 70. So when I was a kid, when I was in my teens or and earlier, my primary fear was not climate change, but nuclear war. And right. It was something. But at that point, it was considered, I think, by many, at least in my, you know, middle class milieu, certainly the adults around me didn't seem to have the same kind of fear of nuclear war that I did at the age of 12, 13, 14. It was a juvenile paranoia, you know, in the 80s. But I think in the 60s, it was probably less so.
Yeah, I mean, during the missile crisis, it seemed like it was going to happen. And what was sort of remarkable about the Posadist take on it, and not just Posadist himself, but the real intellectuals in the organization, like Adolfo Gili, who's, every leftist in Mexico knows and reveres Adolfo Gili for his book about the Mexican Revolution and his journalism about the Zapatistas. He was a founding member of the Posadas organization, and he was in Cuba during the missile crisis. And he wrote an article for the Monthly Review about, among other things, what Havana was like during the missile crisis. And what he was really impressed by is that Cuban people weren't, you know, running for the countryside. They weren't stockpiling food. He said that revolutionary fervor was at an all-time high, that production actually went up, that people, you know, were ready to fight to the death, even though they knew that if Havana was bombed, that was it. Like, there was not going to be a Cuba anymore. It's a small country. If it's nuked, that's the end of it. They not only accepted their fate as a element, as a domino in world revolution, but they wanted it, and they were mad when it didn't happen. They the Posadists argue that they were mad at the USSR and mad at Castro for backing down in the missile crisis. So this is something that's kind of like unimaginable for us today. Like, we would think for sure that it's good that there wasn't a nuclear war. Mm-hmm. But not every revolutionary socialist back then liked the idea of peaceful coexistence between the socialist world and the imperialist world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that's insane. But I can understand, I guess, to a degree. I mean, at that moment, the feeling that the Soviet experiment had gone wrong was not as pervasive as it is now. And certainly amongst Trots and you know, other Marxists, connected to really existing socialism. That was not the view was that the Soviet Union and the fact that it had developed the way it had did not indicate any kind of break from the original revolutionary moment.
Well, Posada certainly believed that, but you know, part of like what kind of became weird and after World War II was the class struggle between, you know, the bourgeoisie and the proletariat kind of became abstracted to the struggle between the imperialist states and the worker states. And so, now, yeah.
So how widespread, we've kind of covered the nuclear war aspect of the Posada's doctrine, and it's not as far away from mainstream Fourth International positions as we might think. How far away was the UFO aspect of Posadas's ideology, and how did he come to be interested in UFOs and can join his apocalyptic visions with his visions of flying saucers in the skies?
Well, it was certainly unique, and I've heard rumors that other sects have talked about UFOs, but Posadism is known for it for a reason. And that reason is one of their main intellectuals, one of their founding members, was a guy named Dante Minuzzoli, also an Argentinian, who found the GCI, the Fourth International Group, with Posadas in the 40s. And when the Roswell incident occurred, and when news of Kenneth Arnold seeing flying saucers spread the tabloids in, I believe it was 47.
Yeah.
You know, that news hit Argentina, like a lot of countries, and people started seeing flying saucers in Argentina. So like, this was like a big media event then. And Minuzzoli, who was part of this new Trotskyist group at the time, you know, mostly concerned with what was going on with Peronism, said, you know, these are UFOs. These are alien spacecraft. Aliens are visiting us. This is a very important thing for the history of the world. And we need to analyze this as Marxists and as revolutionaries. And his comrades at the time were like, no, this is not what we're doing right now. We're trying to set up the Fourth International in Argentina and worldwide. Mm-hmm. So he put it on hold until the 60s, when the Posadists became their own international. They believed the international. They believed themselves to be the inheritors of Trotsky and Lenin and Marx. And so these big questions of philosophy, of, you know, science, dialectical materialism, were now on the table. And so Minuzzoli pushed the UFO question again. And he had this, you know, elaborate thesis on it that was based on writings of Lenin and Engels. And other people in the movement, other intellectuals, did not like that he was pushing it still. But Posadas weighed in on it at a Congress, the World Congress in 67. And he gave a speech saying, yes, Minuzzoli, you're right. The UFOs are aliens. Aliens are a higher, you know, if they're able to visit Earth, they have a higher social structure than us. We can learn a lot from them, and we ought to, if we're able to. But, and the whole second part of this, what became the flying saucers essay that's so well known today, is that we don't need to, because we have everything we need on Earth to get rid of poverty, to, you know, we can abolish private property, we can unite as a species, we can get to this next level of sustainability and unity on our own. We don't need aliens to do it. Mm-hmm. And that was the last time Posadas talked publicly or published publicly about the UFO phenomenon. He continued to be weird in a lot of ways. And he continued to be a believer in UFOs, mm-hmm, and aliens. But this was not like an important part of the movement. Minuzzoli was kind of quieted down by it. But then there was, a series of expulsions and sex scandals in the mid-70s. The entire intellectual core left, and Minuzzoli went on to basically dedicate his life to ufology. So he wrote a book about it in the 80s called Why Haven't the Aliens Made Public Contact? and, you know, another member of important member of the Posadas movement, Paul Schultz, believed also, you know, out of the movement in the 80s. Actually, he was still in the movement after the death of Posadas, but he believed he was receiving messages from aliens in the 80s. So, mm-hmm, two Posadists ended up becoming full-time ufologists in the 80s and 90s.
So we have a question that came in from the chat, and they used the super chat to donate a couple bucks. So I feel obligated to throw it on the screen. And in a little bit, we'll ask for more questions and more super chats, and you don't have to do a super chat to have your question seen, although it increases your chances, I'll notice. So they ask, any thoughts on Red Star by Alexandra Bogdanov, and the influence of socialist themes in sci-fi?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a major thing I was thinking about in this book, and I talk a lot about Bogdanov in the book. I'm very interested in the way that science fiction at some point influences or becomes indistinguishable from a real narrative of the way the world works. And so Red Star is a great example of that because he wrote that following the 1905 revolution in Russia. Bogdanov was a very important Bolshevik figure during this time. He was a rival of Lenin for leadership of the party. And him and Lenin had some very different ideas about what the Bolshevik party would be. And a lot of this had to do with some of his philosophical ideas that he expressed in Red Star. And that's a little bit too complicated to get into now. Mm-hmm. But basically Bogdanov, to a lot of people, although it's not, he's not like the best figure to represent this, represents cosmism and biocosmos immortalism, this kind of mystical sci-fi futurist tendency in revolutionary socialism that was like a major cultural moment in the Soviet public in the 20s, because Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who was one of the forefathers of rocketry, really wanted part of the Soviet project to be visiting space, having fraternal relations with aliens. And although this became suppressed in the 20s and 30s, and a lot of those cosmists ended up dying, via Stalin or otherwise, the idea remained and became a big part of the Soviet space program. And a cosmist, Sergei Korolev, would go on to launch Sputnik. So there's this direct movement from sci-fi to the space race.
Yeah, I've heard rumors, or at least read somewhere, that Gene Roddenberry was either a fellow traveler with a trot group or was involved with an American trot group at some point.
I found an essay where Trotz claimed that Roddenberry was influenced by Posadas. I think that's absolutely impossible, but
okay. So and he was not, you don't think he was ever involved with any communist groups in the United States?
Yeah, I've never seen any evidence of that. And
okay, I believe that that's the case regardless of the lack of evidence.
I think that Marxists and socialists had an influence on the show in later years. There's a book by I can't remember his name right now, but a professor at the University of Miami. He wrote two books, one saying that Star Trek is socialist and one saying that Star Trek is Hegelian. And he argues that he's not like a literary, he's not like seeing like these themes in it. He says, no, these writers are putting out socialist and Hegelian themes. I think maybe it's right. A bit too much, but it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to the Posadas moment. I mean, how did he come to be an advocate for communicating with dolphins?
In a very late in life, like his last year and a half, he discovered the work of Igor Charkovsky, who was a Russian dissident midwife. And it's hard to know exactly what he was reading, but I think he was probably reading some like New Age tabloids. And Charkovsky was the inventor a pioneer of water birthing. And some of his water birthing experiments took place in the Black Sea. And he believed that dolphins would naturally come up to women giving birth and become, they were these like natural midwives. And further, that if a child was born in water and if a dolphin helped, the children would basically have superhuman powers. So he believed that dolphins and humans have this psychic connection because they have this similar mammal origin from the sea. And also that, we can move on to the next stage of humanity. The new man can be created through water birthing. And this, as far as I can tell, is the extent of Posadas' interest in dolphins. I've only found like two or three things that he wrote on this subject, but it's very similar to the work of John Lilly and other kind of new age.
Yeah. Weird, I was thinking of Lilly
thinkers. It's something that was in the air in the 70s. It seems like the
left just went through the same. I mean, basically everyone on the left went through similar things at similar times in history. So when a lot of the American left anyway was retreating into new ageism, it's no surprise that someone like Posadas might be as well. Which brings us, I guess, to this moment where he's resurged. Mm-hmm. And how do you explain the resurgence of Posadism? And when do you think it really starts? I mean, I met, have you met Comrade Communicator?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I met Comrade Communicator at the Left Forum in mm-hmm. 2017 and interviewed him for a podcast, this podcast. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it seemed like just one guy who had a funny joke, but I guess it's built up a bit from there. Is that when it started with him?
He was a big part of popularizing it. Basically, Posadas remained this in-joke amongst Trotskyists and other socialists for a long time. And in I think 2003, a guy named Matthew Salisbury wrote an article about Posadism for the Fortean Times, which is actually like, you know, it's very hyperbolic. He calls it a Trotskyist.
Uh-oh. You're frozen. See, this is where if you try to be too critical of the Posadist movement, they will intervene. Hopefully he'll be coming back in just a moment here. It looks like, oh, here he is. All right.
Sorry about that.
No trouble.
So, yeah, there's a Fortean Times article. That was the first time, you know, people heard about Posadist's weirdness in like a non-weird leftist source. And so there's a little bit of like folklore around him after that. In the early 2010s, David Broder translated the Flying Saucer essay for Marxist.org. So there's like, you know, even more like talk on message boards amongst like leftists interested in like weird ephemera. But then in 2015, around then, Aaron Bastani coins this meme of fully automated luxury communism. And so there begins to be this proliferation of memes around that on Reddit and on Facebook. And people added new little things to the memes, including fully automated luxury space communism. So that became its own meme with a life of its own. Mm-hmm. And within that, people started adding Posadas to it. And people, you know, started researching Posadas for like fodder for the memes. And then from there, they added, you know, he basically became his own spinoff character and had all these spinoff meme pages. And not only was it like this kind of silly thing, you know, for bored kids online, but people actually had this kind of interest in building the folklore around it. So I've seen a number of discussions on message boards, on Facebook, on Twitter, of people speculating about who Posadas was and what it's all about. People, you know, weighing in very authoritatively with things that never happened, like that he was like tortured or a victim of an MKUltra kind of experiment, that kind of thing. And so Comrade Communicator and I, you know, I really liked what he was doing with the meme page. I thought they were really funny and kind of he was making some interesting, weird points and like interesting satire of the left with what he was doing. We talked about writing something together. And as I was writing it, I thought, you know, the story of Posadism is in itself, you know, the true story is really interesting and no one's really written about it in English. And so I met some other leftist train spotters like Mackenzie Wark, Sebastian Budgen, David Broder, who are all very interested in someone writing this story.
All of those people are frenemies of mine. So so what was the political aim, do you think, of? Well, okay, I have to ask you this first. Have you met Comrade High Commander?
No, I've walked up and down the shore from Coney Island to Brighton Beach at dusk. You know, I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I think I'm a little bit of a skeptic. So you think
maybe he's not real is what you're saying.
I couldn't say he's not real, but it's like the UFO phenomena or any paranormal phenomena. You're more likely to experience it if you believe in it, if you really believe in it.
Yeah, but the thing about the UFO phenomenon is, as of just a couple of days ago, there's authenticated actual footage of UFOs.
Right.
I've never seen a picture of Comrade High Commander. Mm-hmm. So what do you think Comrade Communicator's political aims are when it comes to this project? I mean, what is the critique of the left that he's putting forward?
Well, he wrote a great zine called Marxism as well. I think Comrade High Commander wrote it, and maybe he published it or something. But it's called Marxism as Futurology. He's got it on his website, and essentially he's arguing that I think the broader idea is that the left has come to this place where it's sort of reenacting these past struggles and movements, like Bolshevism obviously wasn't always this like weird sectarian thing that has like a million little group hustles splintering out from it. It mm-hmm. used to be like a force of millions of people. Anarchism used to represent millions and millions of workers worldwide, like with a common idea. The 68 wasn't just this like weird new left, like bundle of slogans and art. It was actually, workers and students in revolt all over the world. So the left has sort of taken these like important real moments of struggle and turned them into something to like reenact. And where, like as Marx talks about in the 18th Brumaire, wear the costumes of these revolutionary figures in hopes to make their ghosts walk again or something. Mm-hmm. And Comrade Communicator has a slogan, first time is tragedy, second time is farce, third time is LARP. And that's not fully a condemnation of it, because Marx himself says that when revolutionaries reach this point where, history is a nightmare, everything's failed, and they have no idea how to proceed to the future, really the moment that we're in, it's actually helpful to put on these costumes of failed revolutionaries in order to like figure out like a strategy or a new way forward. And I think that's what he does with Posadas, although he's not really like claiming the literal Posadas line, the Posadas that still exist certainly don't recognize him as a Posadist.
How many still exist right now?
A handful, and they're almost all very old. One thing that I don't really understand is why they don't try to recruit, like in Argentina, in Montevideo, they still march. They still go out to demonstrations. They're part of the Frente Amplio and the Kirchnerist movements. And I think they're part of the PT in Brazil as well.
For them, is the need for nuclear war still part of their platform? I imagine that they are, I would imagine they've retreated back into a more traditional kind of Trotsky's vision.
Yeah, they have. Leon Cristalli, Posadas's son, who's, as far as I can tell, the leader of the contemporary Posadas movement, says that Posadas's vision of a nuclear war happening essentially came to pass by different means. And one thing that he said was an example of that is that the SARS and swine flu and bird flu and H1N1 and all that stuff were a new kind of nuclear war that killed many people worldwide. And what interestingly, he said this maybe 5 or 6 years ago. So I think although that was kind of a strange point to make back then, when those, didn't really rise to the level of pandemic. Mm-hmm. Now, arguably, if this turns out to be man-made or a bioweapon in some way.
Or even if it isn't.
Right. Really. He will, if it's, related to capitalism, although I don't think he would blame China for it. His point is that the kind of destruction that capitalism will resort to and needs to resort to in order for us to move to the next level has happened. But they don't talk about nuclear war very much. Interestingly, they still talk about aliens a little bit from time to time, but mostly just reposting things about SETI.
Well, I would imagine, I can't not ask this question. What do you think sincerely now about the release of these videos of UFOs that the Navy had, I guess, and that the Pentagon has authenticated. Do you feel like this in any way vindicates people who were considering an extraterrestrial hypothesis, or does it open the door at all in that arena? Or what do you think personally?
Well, I've always believed that the UFO phenomena is real because, you know, you can disprove 90% of UFO sightings, but you can't account for that 10%. And that's the UFO phenomena. So the government, the military admitting very openly that there are UFOs and they're in U.S. airspace and we don't know what to do with them. We don't know what they are. You know, they're that's an interesting moment for sure. There's no evidence that they're extraterrestrial in origin. People make that leap immediately and for no reason, really. I think it's a little bit less interesting to say that they're that UFOs are aliens, you know. I'm mostly...
You don't know the aliens the way I do. I think they're very interesting.
Well, what do you think?
No. But I don't think it's less interesting for them to suppose that they might be extraterrestrial or from somewhere other than Earth. Mm-hmm. I do agree that there's no evidence in the UFO phenomenon as it is that they're from other stars. But we do have to ask, what is it about these phenomenon that make them unidentified? I mean, what is the criteria right. to be unidentified? If it's just that some footage of something in the sky was captured and it's too grainy to know exactly what it is, that's one thing. If it's that the behavior of the object in the sky was such that it seems to be unexplainable by either our current technology or by some natural phenomenon, then that's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the second category is what we're talking about when we're talking about the UFO footage that was released and authenticated recently. But I'm not sure of that. Do you know?
What's the second category?
The second category is phenomena that cannot be explained as either natural phenomenon or technologically. That it's not merely a matter of it not be like, you know, if a blimp is in the sky and it's far enough away and I see a dot, I can't identify it. That's an unidentified flying object, right?
Yeah.
But that's not the same thing as the UFO where it's tracked on radar. There's, you know, airplanes out there trying to catch up to it. And it behaves in ways which go beyond what the scope of what we think is possible or from our, you know, technologically for us, and that we can't explain as some sort of natural phenomena that, you know, that maybe we don't have a full grasp on, but we have some idea about. We can't explain it, basically. I mean, I can explain something I can't identify.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think that I haven't read any compelling explanations at all of these things, except for some people who I think are kind of, you know, trying to cash in on it, like Jeremy Corbell in certain ways, claiming that that's related to Area 51 experiments or whatever, or to the Stars Academy, which is, you know, Tom DeLonge's project in connection with Lockheed Martin and Robert Bigelow, who's a space entrepreneur, Rich Hotelier. They say that they want to reverse engineer a UFO. They want you to invest into the Stars Academy so they can do this. They're going to do this, of course, if it is real. They're doing it in conjunction with the military. So the military is going to get that technology, and it's not a public good.
These days, I think the drone technology is so advanced that it's impossible to really put to really understand what would be extraterrestrial in nature. In other words, what can the drones do, and how can we, you know, and how can we distinguish drones from other things, even if we are, you know, skilled in aviation and things like that. I think that we're at a point now where the mastery of the air is so complete that almost you could just throw a rock and you're going to hit some sort of man-made object. So I would expect that eventually it will come out that those devices were drones of some kind. That's at least what they seem
certainly
to be.
if if the account of David Fravor, who was the pilot who saw the 2004 Tic Tac UFO, mm-hmm. is to be believed, and I think he's a pretty credible source from what I can tell, mm-hmm. It's not a drone. It's something that you know, is physically doing things that we can't understand. You know, I don't know if there's something weird about the story. I don't know if he's a, you know, a government psyop or something like that. It's very likely that the fact that the Navy has to have like new procedures for reporting UFOs is because there's a lot of drones being flown now. But these, this Tic Tac and gimbal, if it's a drone, it's something of foreign origin or something the government's experimenting on, and almost no one knows about it.
Do you think that this is off to the side of whether UFOs are real, or flying, whether the flying saucer people are real? Do you think that the reason that Comrade Communicators memes and jokes took hold was because they reinforced a move away from a Marxist politics or a radical socialist politics, and justified in some ways a move towards social democratic politics and electoralism after Trump's election? That it was a way that it was a part of, maybe a symptom of, the disillusion or the dissolving of the sectarian left.
Well, interestingly, his meme page, the IWLP on Facebook, became very popular during the election. I mean, maybe you can still make that argument because this was like basically after the Sanders campaign was defeated. But I think in general, politics became really interesting again with Trump and with Sanders. And so young people especially started looking into, you know, all these weird tendencies within politics and how weird and extreme politics can be, because you're online. So you might as well, you know, profess any crazy belief. That's why you had so many like bizarre sects of Nazis popping up around the Trump campaign and on 4chan and such. And so you saw something like that on the left. And there's a really interesting study recently that I cite in the book. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but it's about the My Political Journey meme, where people have this four quadrants thing. And, you know, you start off as a liberal and you end up being, you know, whatever. And there's this tendency of these young memester people to you know, go more and more extreme until they're off the spectrum. And each step of the way they describe it was some weird combination of tendencies from the past. So they're like a, you know, a Juche eco-nihilist or a Sternerite Avolian or whatever. And Posadas was one of these, you know, weird like little tropes from socialist history that just gets like very carelessly thrown into the mix. So I think I don't know if like social democracy, I think, asserted itself as something very different. It asserted itself as the left wing of the possible, something that could be achieved within the U.S. political institutions. And, you know, you can get a congressperson here or, somebody on the town.
Or president there.
Right. Or, you know, maybe like, and that's like the craziest thing we can imagine is President Bernie Sanders. Like, that's the, you know, we can't think of like Marxist-Leninist revolution is really, that's like insane sci-fi shit. But Bernie Sanders being president, that's a little bit more plausible. So I think what's going on with the memes and like all the weird combinations of extreme tendencies is the desire for people to dream and believe and, you know, identify in ways that are deeply impossible. And I think you're right that it's outside of class struggle. But the question I pose in the book is it just a joke? Is it just people entertaining themselves online because they're too depressed about how hopeless everything is, or through this, or through meeting history, through you know, looking at what the Posadists really were, what Trotskyism really was, what really happened in the Revolution in World War II, can people learn this faith that millions and millions of revolutionaries had in the first half of the 20th century, and believe that it's possible again to have and win a revolution?
You should hold up your book, and I'm going to hold up mine at the same time, because I wrote a book a couple of years ago. It's a novel nominated for the Philip K. Dick Award called After the Saucers Landed. I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, this was 2017. This book came out.
I wish we could just trade it through the split screen. Here. Yeah. We don't have that technology yet.
Yeah, soon. And the reason I bring it up is in my novel, the idea was that the saucers land. There's ufologists are some of the main characters. And they're on the left. They're part of an avant-garde movement called Fluxus, and they became ufologists. And what they realized is after the saucers landed that their whole reason for being has gone away, that the saucer people fit into the current society as easily as anything else. And and then there's, of course, the plot of trying to find out what the aliens are really up to. But my thought when I was writing it was that the need for self-transformation, whether it's, you know, strictly just thought of in terms of overcoming class, although I think that's the primary thing, but the need for self-transformation will remain even after miracles, that there's a human problem that nothing from the outside is going to overcome for us. And I think that that's one of the things that attracted me to Comrade Communicator's critique of the left, was that there's a tendency on the really radical left to end up in this position of like waiting for the saucers to land, waiting for something from the outside.
A literal deus ex machina.
Yeah.
Or this belief that like somehow just by doing what we're doing over and over again, by, you know, handing out a newspaper or breaking a window or posting, somehow it's going to catch fire and revolution's going to spread from like a single act. And of course, it's possible. And there's a certain openness to something crazy happening like that. But it's a little bit diluted. And I think why that is because we haven't really reckoned with the tension between the subjective forces and the objective forces. We don't, you know, it doesn't seem very likely that there's anything we can do right now as workers or as socialists or whatever to change the course of history. It seems like history is going to do that. And Posadas, I think, is attractive because he combines those two poles, a very extreme subjectivism with a very extreme objectivism. We need to make nuclear war happen as soon as possible because nuclear war will level everything. And then the proletariat is finally free to build a socialist world. Extreme optimism with extreme pessimism at the same time. And I think that kind of, the humor in that is what attracts people to him.
I'm going to tell you one more story. Please forgive me here, but
please.
And it's about myself. That's what you really need. Why I really need to be forgiven. But the before I did the podcast for Zero Books and started here about 5 years ago now, I was doing a podcast called Diet Soap, which had started in 2009. And before it was a podcast, it was a zine back in I think 93 or so. And the very first issue of Diet Soap had a picture of the magic bullet from the JFK assassination on it. And the motto was, we wanted to be the magic bullet for the revolution, to get our ideas everywhere. Oh, you're frozen and probably not there anymore. Okay. But for people who are watching, getting our ideas everywhere at once, you know, in a way that wouldn't make any rational sense. So that we were going to fire the first bullet of the revolution, but it was going to be ideas and it would be magical. That was the idea when I was 22 years old and living in a studio apartment in Portland. But I guess my point is only that if I was any indication, you're there now. Okay. My point is only that if I was any indication that this problem, this way of thinking has been around for a while. Anyhow. So we should take some questions from the chat before we sign out. So what's the Posadas stance on the value form or on the value, law of value?
I haven't seen Posadas write anything about value form theory, which makes sense because he died in 1981. Comrade Communicator's DMs are open. You could ask him. Personally, I'm working through Volume 3 right now, so I think Volume Form Theory is going to be my next step. So maybe I'll have something to say after that, but I don't have a good answer myself.
Mm-hmm. See if there's any other questions. Was there a question that I should have asked you that I didn't?
I mean, I would love to nerd out about Trotskyism more, but maybe that's for another podcast.
Okay.
Oh, you know, another thing we could talk about is alternate ideas of the paranormal, like Valet's ultra-terrestrial hypothesis, Fordian concepts. And I think that's really interesting connecting it to Adorno's concept of Adorno-Horkheimer's idea of, you know, the, what do they call it? Not demystification, de-enchantment of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, I think in a way, UFOs are this way of asserting the irrationality, the gaps in consensus reality that we're lacking in believing that everything is accounted for and we can perceive everything and categorize it scientifically. But again, these are maybe topics for another discussion.
Yeah. Let's see here. See if there's a question I missed. People are talking about suggesting that people check out the Berman truck video by Renegade Cuts, which is a YouTuber, I guess. Well, listen, has your book gotten some pretty good reviews so far? How's the reception to your book been so far?
I had a good review in the Baffler and in Jacobin. Those are the first two that came in.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I'll put links to them in the description for this video. I have begun it. I've obviously, from our conversation, I haven't read the entire thing, but I look forward to reading it all. And I think it's a great topic. I do worry. I legitimately worry that this interest in Posadas is a reflection of our disillusion with the radical Marxist left, that we're sort of giving up on the prospect of revolution when we joke around about the alien dolphin loving overlords arriving to help us with communism. But at the same time,
why wouldn't we, you know, like what's like what party are we going to join? Like, you know, in the
only reason not to, the only reason not that we have a positive reason to embrace it. It's just that capitalism itself clearly is not functional. And the contradictions in capitalism are such that if we don't overcome them, the outcome will be so dire. I mean, I'm not saying it's like, you know, apocalyptic, but I'm just saying it's unlivable and unacceptable to not overcome the contradictions in capitalism and arrive at a new basis for society.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of socialism and barbarism, or socialism or barbarism, isn't that you know, capitalism will break down and then we'll have socialism. This is basically what Posadas believed, and this was, you know, totally wrong. The idea was that we need to build something to replace capitalism when it breaks down, because capitalism can't last forever. That's just a fact. So the idea that Trotsky actually, you know, before World War II, he wrote about how the Fourth International was going to be the flag bearer of the world revolution. He was very triumphalist about this. You know, you needed to believe that in the Fourth International, you were building the new world revolutionary cadre. But he also said at one point that, you know, if I'm wrong, if the course of the war doesn't turn out the way I say it's going to, if Stalin wins or if Hitler wins or if the US wins, then it's hopeless. This is going to be the slow eclipse of civilization, and revolution will never going to happen again. Trotsky said that in 1940, I think. You know, history didn't turn out the way that the revolutionaries in the first half of the century believed it would, but we need to reckon with that fact. And we have to figure out how to do things differently. This, I think, is an open question by like this new emerging socialist movement being so influenced by irony and cynicism and humor, because we don't have that innate faith that you had in the early 20th century, where you thought for sure capitalism would collapse at any moment. We can't believe that.
Right.
So that puts us at a disadvantage, but also we're not so disillusioned that we're going to join just any wingnut set.
Well, I think I could get enough people to make a pretty, pretty penny if I got it together. I could get a little cult going, I think. So I'll get a few of you people. No, I'm kidding. No, obviously, I don't think any Marxist sect has the answer today. But I think that the revolutionary core of some of those old sectarian groups that have a long history shouldn't be abandoned. That what you're saying is true. We have to rethink, deeply critique, try something new, but we shouldn't limit our horizons to the DSA and to Bernie Sanders.
For example, I opened the book talking about these uprisings that swept the world at the end of last year in in Chile and Hong Kong, Lebanon. You can't even list all, it happened everywhere at the end of last year. It was like the biggest, France, you know, the biggest uprising since 68 worldwide. But it was lacking something. And it was part of what it was lacking was international coordination, something like an international, you know. It's not because, you know, we could just say like, oh, the Fourth International was a failure, so there was no sense in it. There is tremendous sense in it. They want to provide a program. They want to provide a way that people could be militants against capitalism. It was kind of the right idea, but it failed for a number of reasons. And the fact that it became, you know, this, it splintered into a million different little cults like the Posadists, and they weren't even the weirdest ones. There are even weirder little Marxist-Leninist cults. There's something about the nature of that recapitulation of Leninism that needs to be reckoned with.
Can you name one of the weirder cults out there, just so we can have some shits and giggles after?
There's a podcast called Let's Talk About Sects, S-E-C-T-S. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember the name of the group, but it's something like, you know, Marxist-Leninist Research Institute or something that existed in England in the 70s and 80s. They were very orthodox Maoist, but the leader believed that China had a satellite called Jackie, a very Philip K. Dick kind of idea. And Jackie, if you disobeyed him, Jackie would strike you down. The CIA was like beaming messages at him from parking meters and stuff like that. And people were in this cult for a very long time. And I think there's even trials still going on now about the kind of abuse that they received. And in general,
from Jackie, right?
From the leader of the group.
But even
more banal examples of Trotskyist sects where there weren't that kind of abuse. There wasn't, you know, sexual abuse that was very common in new communist movements. Even banal ones, you know, arguably show signs of cultishness. And this was the argument of Teresh and Wolferth in a book called On the Edge, Political Extremism on the Right and Left, I think it's called. So I think, you know, even though there's like this fascination with cults today, you know, people my age don't really want to join a cult. You know, they don't want to submit to that kind of discipline, even though it would make them into better communist militants. That's not where our heads are at.
Mm-hmm. I tell you, I think you're overlooking the power of the cult. No one wants to, if you call something a cult, obviously it's not worth joining. And so I don't think any young person, I want to say this right to the camera, no young people should get involved with cults. Mm-hmm. They're bad news. Sectarian Marxist groups, probably not a good idea either. But there's got to be some form for a more radical socialist project. And it seems as though somehow we've reached a point where it's either sectarian cults or the Democratic Party. And I don't even know if the sectarian cults ultimately are actually really split from the Democratic Party, or if they're just little, you know, I don't know, test marketing groups for the Democrats.
In that book I just mentioned, they actually argued they're ex-Trotskyists, Wolferth and I forget his name, but they argue that there's like a spectrum of like, you know, a extreme Leninism is at one extreme is a cult, And at the other extreme is something that looks more like the DSA. And I think one of them is actually in the DSA. So their solution to the cultism of Leninism is the DSA. And I think they made this argument like years ago before the Trump bump, before the DSA got so big.
Mm-hmm.
That's not exactly what I want to argue, though, because I agree with you. I think there is something valuable about that militancy that the Trotskyist had, that discipline that you know, you, if you're in the movement, you need to distribute the paper. You need to lay out the paper, distribute it. You need to, you know, go to the demonstration. You got to bring people into the group. You know, this is what your life is. You're a militant for this organization. Mm-hmm. I think we're lacking that today, you know. But also, you know, growing up, I was more in like the anarchist ultra left milieu, and we would make fun of those people. Like, we didn't want to be like that. We thought we were better than them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not saying that the discipline in the newspapers are what would recommend the sectarian Marxist left. It was more, I think, the introduction, and I think this is something that the American trot tradition, and you can tell I come out of an anarchist background too, because I call them trots. I think that they fell down on training young people with in Marxism and the history of socialism to a large extent. Instead, they would indoctrinate people with whatever their particular leader's ideas were.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the idea, the one thing that is to recommend these old sectarian groups is that they still held to an understanding of the necessity for a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that understanding that through a thoroughgoing critique of capitalism, and one that's pluralistic, in other words, one where people have different interpretations of what capitalism is. Maybe, you know, some people are more of fans of Kautsky or fans of Trotsky or fans, you know, some people read Marx actually himself. That would be what I would prefer. But I think that kind of aim, that horizon, the horizon being revolution, radical, really radical change, that's what we're losing when we lose these cults. And the truth is we've already lost that as soon as they were sectarian cults. Maybe I'm just coming to terms with the fact that, you know, the death of Marxism has finally fully arrived. There's not even the zombies left, but all that's left are the memes.
Yeah. I agree with a lot of what you say. And for this reason, you know, I'm interested in like the kind of thing Platypus is doing. Cause I feel like Platypus is sort of, you know, incorporating a lot of what you're saying.
Oh my God. I just realized I was espousing a plat line.
Exactly.
I've been brainwashed by yet another sectarian cult.
But in a way, you know, I kind of respect that, you know, they've got this thing where they have a leader and they all dress the same and they, you know, try to come to a same line. I don't necessarily agree with it. I've done a couple panels with them and it's been
with the plats.
Really fine. Yeah. Yeah.
Do they all dress like Chris Catrone now? Is that how bad it's gotten for them?
I don't know if they're still, I remember for a while they had like a kind of a uniform, like a sort of beige dress shirt and black pants. I don't know if that's how he
mm-hmm.
dresses.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that was like commanded from on high, but I do think that there was a certain look and feel
to a
member of the Platypus Affiliated Society. And I will say this for them. It was kind of stylish.
Yeah.
It wasn't bad. It wasn't a bad look. It wasn't, they didn't look like dweebs.
Mm-hmm.
They looked like kind of Ivy League hipsters.
And I mean, know? What other, who are the other Bolshevik groups today in the U.S.? ISO is gone. You've got a handful of Maoist groups. Platypus might be the last one standing.
No, there's got to be a couple more that I just not springing to mind right now. Socialist Action.
Socialist Alternative?
No, yeah, well, Socialist Action, because I don't know exactly where they fell, but they tried to recruit me in the back in the 90s. And so I'm still in contact with Jeff Mackler, their leader, and like send them copies of Zero Books to review and Socialist Action newspaper, which is, you know, their trot newspaper.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, it's a small sect, but it's still around. And, you know, in the 90s, they were concerned about how old everyone was getting. And I don't know how well they did recruiting. They were kind of competing with the ISO, I think, at that time. Everyone, all of these groups are competing with each other for college students. And I guess maybe what happened really is the DSA just totally trashed them over the last 4 years.
And it's a good question of how that happened. Like, were they just better organized? Were they more professional? Or did people just like what Bernie Sanders had to say so much that they wanted to join a group that was similar to Bernie Sanders' message? I think it's probably more of the latter. They kind of had the right
I've talked to DSA members who are young college students, and now admittedly I don't have anything like a controlled sample, or, you know, what I'm about to say is completely anecdotal and not at all representative, but the DSA members I've talked to have always said, I'm a crypto DSAer. I'm more radical than the organization itself. Mm-hmm. I'm going to use the DSA for my own, radical political ends. And I'm going to try to actually, a lot of these young people were saying like, he's like, and I hope to build a new radical organization out of my experience of the DSA.
Mm-hmm.
My own son has his own Communist International in Eugene. He just started a webpage for it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Well, yeah, yeah. But I mean, you know, it's him and his friends, his roommates and a few friends in Eugene. Who knows where that will lead? Maybe in 20, 30 years, he'll have a live stream. I've depressed myself. I'll let you go after we run the end credits, but stick around. We'll talk for a moment. And then after that, I think it's time for me to beam up.
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
we still, to a large extent,